Do it again?
Sure.
So for the sake of the tape recorder, today's topic will be intention. Intention is one of the areas which are sometimes considered to be subtle subjects of mindfulness practice. And there's a few things which are usually not brought into the scope of mindfulness practice when people are relatively new to mindfulness practice. But as they begin to mature and develop in the practice, one of the areas that's included as part of the domain, part of what we notice in our daily life, is our intention, the intention that we bring. And the intention can get very subtle, and you get a little bit of a sense of that from the traditional Buddhist teaching that every moment of mind, every mind moment, which is very fast, contains an intention. There's always an intention in every mind moment. And, you know, if you just think about the degree in which we move our body, you know, we move our legs, our arms, our hands, move around, very few of us sit still for very long. Maybe we body stay still. If we're sleeping, perhaps, or if we're maybe in meditation, perhaps, we stay still. Usually it was constant little bit adjusting and making things look better and scratching and just getting, you know, making ourselves more comfortable or avoiding some discomfort. And each of the small movements of the body is preceded by an impulse or an intention, an impulse or desire to do something. Every time we decide to pursue a train of thought, a thought arises and we get involved in that particular kind of thought, there's an intention to get involved, which is operating. So intentions are operating very, very fast, very subtly, all the time. And it becomes one of the areas that becomes very important for the development and further development of mindfulness practice, to get a sense of it. Mindfulness practice is the practice of paying attention to what is happening in the present moment, bringing an increasingly strong development of mindfulness, of attention, of awareness, of presence into the present moment so we can live with greater freedom in the present moment. And so we sometimes then describe, as most of you know, the areas in which we pay attention to. And in short, we actually pay attention to everything. But we talk about the breath, we talk about our bodily experiences, we talk about our emotions, we talk about our thoughts. Now, intentions is also belongs in this field because it's one of the things that's going on. But intention is particularly important because beginning to get a handle or a sense or understanding of the intentions which drive our life, we can understand the amount of choice we have in terms of responding or acting or not acting on our impulses. And when we see the choice, there's a possibility for more freedom. And the more subtle the mindfulness becomes with intention, understanding the intentions, motivations we have, the greater is your free choice. If we don't see we have choices, if we don't see the intentions that precede our actions, then there's no free choice in relation to those things. Then we act impulsively. We say something, and then afterwards we regret we said that, or afterwards we're happy we said that, but we don't consider beforehand what the intent is for why we want to say it. In a sense, in paying attention to what happened to the present moment, it's possible to divide our present moment experience into two general or broad categories of what's happening. And the first category is, in the very technical definition of it, is what is happening. There's what's happening. That's one category. It's what you can know through your awareness. You know, you hear a sound, you can know you're hearing a sound. You can have a thought, and you can know you can have a thought. You can have a bodily sensation or bodily movement, and you can know that's happening, the awareness of it. So anything that's happening is considered to be the first category. The second category is how we respond to what's happening, how we act on it, what our impulses are in relationship to it, our reactivity. So I could hear the sound, and I could react to that sound and say, well, that's a terrible sound, I don't like that sound. Why do they choose to have a meditation group in a place that has less that kind of sound? I'm going to go find another meditation group. So the mind has gotten involved. And that kind of involvement is all preceded by intentions. There's a motivation or interest, impulses which goes into that. There's a relationship we have. There's a response we have to the listening, to the sounds. We have an itch. And there's a response we have to it. There's a wonderful, maybe we eat some wonderful food, and it isn't just simply wonderful and we just enjoy the wonderfulness, but we respond to that wonderfulness by saying, I want more of that. And so we eat more than we really need to, and we stuff ourselves, or we rush out to the store to get more of it, or, you know, whatever we do. There's a response to what's happening. And it's the world of our response, our responsiveness, which has a lot to do with the degree to which we suffer and the degree to which we're happy or at ease or free. And the world of response has a lot to do with intention, with motivation. We don't respond kind of, well, many of us respond blindly, but we don't respond kind of neutrally. There isn't like this kind of natural flow of response. I'm going to respond this way because, you know, just that's what's flowing through me. As the mind gets more and more subtle and more precise, you see that the impulses which you act, sometimes people say, I just feel like it. And that's good enough reason. It's my natural feelings. I just want to do it. But people who say that aren't really looking very carefully into the subtlety of what precedes the impulse, or what creates the impulse, what's behind it. And as we become more and more subtle in mindfulness, we become aware of the tremendous play that intention, motivation, our intentionality plays in all the things that we do. One way maybe to look at this is, and maybe it's not a good way, but it just occurred to me today, is when I read about or hear about accounts of people learning meditation or mindfulness practice in the military or in corporate America, I sometimes pause in wonder. and I wonder, you know, what is the intention with which the practice is being done? Because I can imagine, and hopefully it's not the case, but I can imagine someone desiring to do a meditation practice or mindfulness practice in order to become a less stressed and more efficient fighter, or a less stressed and more efficient competitor, so I can get more, I can sell more, or whatever the corporate goal might be. And mindfulness can help in those purposes because you're less stressed, you're more attentive. If you're more attentive to your feelings and how you're reacting, then maybe if you're a car salesman, you can keep your poker face longer. and manage to sell more cars. And then I want, you know, part of this wondering then, when I hear about mindfulness in that context, is what about the traditional Buddhist context, the traditional Buddhist intention for mindfulness practice, and that's the intention leading us towards liberation or freedom from our greed, from our hate, and our delusion. It's possible in a subtle, maybe not so subtle ways, of to use mindfulness so we can be more efficient in our greed, like the car salesman, right? So he really wants money, and so he's going to learn how to, you know, stay calm and relax through mindfulness so he can, you know, make more money. It kind of serves as greed. And it's possible to use mindfulness to actually move us in the direction of becoming free of greed, of hate, and of delusion. And that's a traditional Buddhist intention, is that inclination of the mind to that kind of freedom. What is your intention when you do the mindfulness practice? Intention plays a big part on our inner life and the well-being of our inner life. If you take two business people, maybe they're going to they're co-founders of some business, and they put in the same amount of money, the same amount of work into making this business succeed. But the two of them have very different intentions that they bring to that activity. They've made a choice. The choice is to start this business. They engage their life in this activity. Maybe they're in Silicon Valley and they work 80 hours a week because that's what you expected when you start up here. So they're really involved, they're really serious about this. But they bring very different motivations and intention to that work. I can imagine one of them maybe is motivated by greed. He or she wants to just be able to retire at 30 with $1 million. And making a lot of money really quickly is the point, name of the game. And let's try to do this really well to make money. The other person's intention might be, rather than greed or to making money, might be, and I know people who started businesses and this was their intention, so I know it can be done. Their intention was to create an environment for for the workers, for the employees, that was compassionate and caring, that had was concerned about their well-being in more ways than just simply the bottom line for the company, or in more ways than just simply, let's try to make the most out of these workers we can for the sake of the company. The intention for these people I've known was, how can I make a nice, warm environment, a nice cooperative environment where we make enough money to support everyone, but we make money to support everyone and to draw out the best in everyone. So everybody has a place where they feel a sense of community, place where they can be honest and feel that the honesty is highly valued, a place that's cooperative, a place that brings out the best in people. I've known people who started businesses like that. And so these two mythical peoples who start this company then. One intention is greed, and one is the intention is to create a compassionate place. After 2 or 3 years of starting up and running this kind of business, the inner life of these two people will be very different from each other, depending on what the intentions is they're acting on. When we act on a certain intention, we're kind of fueling and strengthening that part of ourselves. So if we're acting on intentions of greed, we're fueling and strengthening those intentions of greed. And some people make the comment that greed never has enough. That as soon as you get what you want, the empty feeling of greed is still there, and then it just wants more, and it wants more, because it's very hard to fill greed or ambition. The inner life, which has been motivated for a number of years by compassion and concern for the employees and creating a nice work environment, that inner life will be very different than the inner life of the person who's greedy. There might be more a sense of a satisfaction in the fact that maybe we've made it that way, or there's a sense of increasing sensitivity to the people around them. People who are pursuing greed, the inner life tends to become less sensitive to the inner life of other people. The person who's compassionately concerned, spends 2 or 3 years interested in that, is cultivating that ability to be sensitive, cultivating all kinds of things in the inner life, inner qualities. It's very interesting to see what happens if the business fails financially. And so the business goes out of business. They go bankrupt. And everybody has to be laid off, and everybody goes home. The person whose main intention and motivation for the business was that of greed is probably measuring the success of the company on whether it made a profit or not. If it didn't, it's an utter failure financially, then the person might feel really miserable or depressed or sad or whatever. The person whose intention was to create a compassionate place might not be so concerned about the failure of the business as much as the other person, but rather might review the last few years and say, was I able to follow through on my compassionate impulse? Was I able to be a kind and supportive employer for my employees? Was there a sense of honesty among the people I worked with? Was there a sense of cooperation? And he or she might say, yeah, there was that. We actually had that. That was pretty phenomenal. And the person might leave a failed business and say, I actually feel quite good about part of what was going on. The intention not only affects the development of the inner life, but it affects dramatically how we review what's really important for us in terms of success and failure as we go through our life. So I don't know if that was a good example or not. It's the one I thought about today. I hope that then made some sense. I'm trying to distinguish between two people can do two very, very similar things, but with very different intentions. And the different intentions makes a world of difference between the inner life of those two people. The example I gave some weeks ago was, I met this woman. I did a one-day meditation retreat at the Women's Federal Prison in Fullerton? Where is it? On the other side of the bay. Dublin.
Dublin.
Maybe that's where it was. Yeah. And you went in, you know, there's always lots of barbed wire. Boy, I've never seen so much barbed wire in my life. And I spent a day with these women and leading a day of mindfulness. And there was one woman there who'd been in prison for a number of years. And she had devoted herself. Her intention, her motivation while she was in prison was to develop her spiritual life. And she devoted herself to yoga and to meditation. And she had this presence and this sparkle, this clarity, this brilliance about her that I find even very rare, even in all the spiritual circles I go to, even in Asia, you know, and teachers there. I mean, there was a sense of presence and strength and peace in her that was quite phenomenal. And then there were other people who were just there because, you know, a guy was coming to campus, and you know, you know, and it's kind of interesting. You know, you don't have to do much, and you just kind of sit around, and you know, they tell you to close your eyes and watch your breath, but no one's following up on you, and so they were kind of falling asleep, and there was that sense of spark wasn't there. And what I was sensing in her was in part the result of a number of years of very powerful intention to use her time in prison a certain way. Someone else can spend their time in prison and be resentful and be dreaming about vengeance. To be spend the time in thoughts of resentment and vengeance, that is to be acting on intention. It's a subtle intention, but to maintain thoughts of vengeance and resentment through time, there's intention. There's an intentionality involved in wanting to continue thinking about those things. Many times we feel like we have no control over our mind, what our mind does and what our feelings are. And partly that's because we're not very subtle with our mindfulness. We don't operate with very much mindfulness. We don't see very clearly what is actually happening deep inside of ourselves. And we don't see the subtle choices we make as we go about, planning our revenge. We think, oh, this is just, of course I should be planning revenge because I deserve to, because society screwed me up. And so this is just natural to think this way. It is not natural. It's a choice that people make. And a person could spend 2 years planning revenge and 2 years planning, 2 years doing a spiritual practice, and both people have spent the same amount of time in the same jail and come out very different people because of it. The inner life is deeply affected. Buddhism makes this point quite dramatically by saying that what endures, what remains through time, is not our actions, but rather the intention behind the action. You do something, you have an intention, you do it, and it's over maybe pretty soon. So for example, what's a good example? I come up with silly examples on the spot, but say that speeding when you're driving. That's maybe a very good example. Hopefully it makes you safer drivers if I may use that example. That's my intention. So you decide, you know, your action is to speed, to get there someplace, go get someplace as quickly as you can. So the intention is speed, is to get there. And you get there quickly. And it's over. The action's over, it's done with, finito, great. But the fact that you are acting on that intention and fueling and watering that intention for that 15-minute drive, that tendency to be impatient, that tendency to want to get somewhere, that greed or that grasping, that tendency has been conditioned or fueled or fed or nourished slightly. And it leaves traces in our psyche, it leaves traces in our life. Sometimes it's called seeds. It leaves seeds in us. And those seeds remain long after the action is done. And those seeds then, in modern psychological terms, that we maybe call it conditioning. We're conditioning ourselves, conditioning our habits, we're reinforcing certain habits. But the Buddhist sense is actually, I think, is more mysterious and much wider than just the psychological idea of conditioning. Mysterious because the ways in which the seeds of intention, the ways in which our inner life unfold, have a mysterious quality to it. It's not always so clear the channels that things take. And things sometimes can go submerged from awareness for many, many, many years. And then many years later, the seeds that were planted that time will surface in various ways, in as good memories or remorseful memories. I think many of you know that it's fairly common for meditators, especially people who are relatively new to meditation, to sometimes have memories surface that they haven't thought about for 20 or 30 years. Suddenly, wow. And not always, but sometimes it has to do with things that you're not happy that you did in the past. You hurt someone. And the action is long done. You hurt someone, it's over, they've forgotten. But your inner life, your inner psyche, inner, you know, I don't know, I don't, maybe I don't want to use the word unconscious, but something inside of us doesn't forget. And when the normal busyness, the normal preoccupations, the normal kind of things begin to settle down, then there isn't that kind of a lid over this our inner life. And things which have been waiting for sometimes decades to bubble up finally have a chance to bubble up and show themselves. And sometimes they take the form of memories. And wow, I can't believe I did that. I didn't feel bad about it at the time. I felt kind of smug at the time. But now I feel really lousy. I think I'm going to call the person up and apologize. And the person says, well, I don't remember, even you, but thank you for apologizing. Has any of you had that experience of remembering things you've done from many years past? Yeah? Some of you? No? And it can be also happy memories. I've known people who had very happy memories from childhood, feelings of well-being, of wholeness, and it was lost as they kept growing up and for difficult lives and all kinds of things. And somehow in meditation, they remembered that feeling of wholeness they had as a child. And they remembered it kind of as a physical memory. And that memory then opened up that whole capacity they had to feel wholeness again. It was like the memory became the door, and then they could start feeling more wholeness again in a way they couldn't before because it had been shut down. But sometimes the way the seed, the traces, the way that in our intentionality kind of leaves its traces in us is in the form of memories. And they last much longer than the action. Sometimes in the conditioning. Sometimes in our body. Our body holds a lot of stuff, I think you all know. For example, you know, when we get stressed or get afraid, we lift up our shoulders. Many of us do. Or we tighten our stomach. There's an intention that's in place in order for us to want to do that. We don't often see, we don't have the subtlety often to see the intention behind it. But there's an intention perhaps to protect ourselves. This is a, you know, classic physical way of protecting ourselves. Someone's about to clobber you, you know, we go like that kind of automatically. And if we follow through on that intention to protect ourselves over and over and over again, when there's no mountain lion about to pounce on us, but rather we're afraid of what people are going to think about the clothes we chose to wear that day, or how they're going to, you know, it's all these kind of not so threatening things that we're so anxious about. And so some of the primitive kind of defense mechanism we have come into play not against real threats, but against imagined threats, against protecting our self-identity or self-image. And so the shoulders start going up and up and up and up. And then at some point, it isn't just simply each time, but they actually get kind of frozen. And our muscles get held tension and get held in certain ways that is a result of the cumulative intentions of lifetimes. It's been attributed to Abraham Lincoln that he said that by the time a person is 40, they're responsible for their face. And I think what was behind that was that the cumulative intentions, the cumulative responses and reactions we have to the world are held in our body, in our face. And so if you're always complaining or scrowling or whatever, it can kind of the face never relaxes from it. It just kind of eventually kind of stays stuck that way. So one of the ways, the kind of so-called ways in which the traces of intention remain through time, long after the action is over, is in our body, in what goes on in our body. And this is also fairly common in meditation, is for people to begin to unravel their body, and long-held tensions begin to show themselves and unravel and release themselves. And it's quite nice when that happens. So our motivations. Another way of maybe asking this is, why do you do what you do? Why do you actually reflect deeply why you do what you do? For what intention? For what purpose? For what motive? What's the motivates it? And this can be asked in all kinds of different levels of grossness or subtleness. It can be asked, for example, what is the intention you have with choosing the line of work that you do, with the job that you have? Is there an intention there? There are some people, who have no particular intention, just it was a convenient job, what came along, it's hard to get a job, they're glad they got the job, and now they have enough money and they can kind of live comfortably and that's all that, but there's not much more thought that goes to the job than that. And there are other people who the intention comes first. The intention is, I want to be of service, or I want to express myself in this way, or I wanted to create a business where the sense of compassion permeates all areas of the business. There can be certain intentions that fuel or direct why we do certain jobs. And how often do we ask ourselves that? I think some people in our society don't ask themselves that enough. Or even if you have a job that just may be a job of convenience, is it possible to bring an intention to that job so that it's more than just a job of convenience? When I worked at Green's restaurant, there was a dishwasher. He was a Zen student. And he was there washing his dishes for a long time in the dishwashing machine. And it was very, very fast-paced in the restaurant. And because we were serving like 300, 400 people sometimes for lunch over about a three-hour period. And the waiters and waitresses and bussers would be running in and out with the orders, with the food, with the dirty plates. And they would, in bringing the dirty plates back to the dishwasher was one of the lowest priority things they had on their plate to deal with. So they would just kind of rush in, throw the dirty dishes on this counter and spin around and go to pick up a new dish of food that was ready to be served, taken out to the floor and bring it out mindfully as good Zen students. You know, here you go, and here you go, enjoy your food, and then they'd spin around and take their dishes and rush in. and it added to the chaos of the whole place. So my friend, he made it his intention. He was going to be the dishwasher, so his intention wasn't to be the best dishwasher in town. His intention was to do the job of dishwashing in such a way that would help create a little bit more calmness and ease and mindfulness for the people who were bringing him the dishes. And what that required, he thought, was to try to keep that area really neat, which was really hard because they were always throwing the dishes all over the counter. But he would always try to keep it really neat, so when they came in with their dishes, there was space for their dishes, they didn't have to pile on top of other dirty dishes, and there wasn't some feeling of, oh, I can just kind of scatter them about freely and just kind of run away. And so he worked really hard. He would come to work a little bit early, he'd take shorter breaks, he would work really, really hard and sweat and struggle. And he claims that he made an impact on the whole restaurant. He says the days when he was really working hard to create this little bit of corner of calm and peace in this very chaotic corner of the restaurant, he could feel it kind of permeating out, and the whole place became a little bit calmer, a little bit more settled. I worked at the same time, and I don't remember, but I had a very different job. I was one of the cooks, so. So it's possible to bring, even in a work of convenience, it's possible to bring an intention about how we do that kind of job, what we do there. And it can be very, very beneficial to people we work with, but it's very beneficial to our inner life, to the inner ecology of our psyche, the intentions we choose to act on. If we do a job just kind of blindly with no intention at all, then we're most likely going to be subject to the whims of conditions and conditionality and from inside and around us. So to look at what is the intention of your job. What about the relationships you get into? Do you think about the intention you bring to the relationship? There's often intentions, and they're often unexamined. Sometimes the intentions of certain relationships is, I want protection, I want. You know, this is what I want from the relationship. And it's possible to have very different intentions rather than just, I want. It can be, what can we do together to create a supportive, mutually supportive relationship? Or what can I do for this person who is struggling in their life right now? There's a whole range, there's an infinite number of intentions we can have. But the point in Buddhism is not so much to have a certain right intention exactly, but rather in mindfulness practice to begin paying attention to the intention. And in noticing what the impulses are, the impulses we have to respond in certain ways, to see that we have a choice there, but whether to act on those impulses or not, act on those intentions or not. And then you have some freedom then, and if they seem to be useful intentions, then to act on it. If they're not useful intentions, then maybe it's better just to leave them alone, let them just kind of self-liberate in the places thoughts go when they're not acted on. And in this sense, sitting meditation is very useful, because in sitting meditation, sitting still for half an hour or 45 minutes or however long you sit, is a period of time when you're not going to act on any impulses. You're not going to act on any intentions that come up. You're sitting there and suddenly you think, I got to defrost the freezer right now. Absolutely, the garage needs to be sorted out, or I have to call that person now, or you know, there's all these impulses that come up when we sit. And the commitment in sitting is you're going to sit for the half an hour or 45 minutes. And we learn with time a certain comfort or rest or trust in the zero place. It doesn't have to act on every impulse. And then in daily life, when impulses come up there, you know that place, it doesn't have to act. And so it becomes a little bit easier then to just let the impulse go and not feel that every impulse is your heart's truest wish. It absolutely has to be fulfilled. And, you know, get out of my way, I'm going to do it. So to pay attention to intention before an action. So one of the ways we pay attention to this is in the very gross things we do, like work or relationships, or, you know, there's all kinds of things in our life that you can kind of actually spend some time reflecting about. You know, maybe even go for a walk and reflect. What is my intention with my work? What's my intention in this relationship I'm in? What's my intention? But then it can be also a little more subtly. There's an intention that precedes every act that we do. What is that intention? Do we infuse our actions with what intentions do we infuse our actions with? So, for example, before we go to the store to buy ourselves lunch, there's an intention to go to the store and buy lunch. If we're mindful, we'll notice the hunger, or we notice the impulse. We notice that intention, and we notice the quality of that intention, because it isn't just simply a desire to go to the store, but there's a quality to that intention. There's a texture or flavor to it. The desire to go to the store to buy lunch could be marked by loneliness and wanting to comfort ourselves, and so the intention is to get comfort in our food. The intention behind going to the store to get lunch is that you feel hungry, you're starting to get weak, and you're not going to get through the day very effectively unless you get some more nourishment in there to keep you going. Those two intentions have very different effects on the inner ecology of our life. If we're doing it to nurture ourselves, if we're doing it to comfort ourselves because we're lonely, then we're actually filling some void we feel inside of ourselves with something that doesn't really fill it. We're filling it with sensual pleasure, which doesn't really work. So, in a sense, we might actually be reinforcing the loneliness, the separation, the estrangement from ourselves. So, to notice, what is the intent that I have to go to the store? Oh, is that really to my best purpose? Is that really for my best, my well-being, to go there because I'm lonely? Maybe if I'm lonely, there's a different way of addressing my loneliness than using food. So you can use a kind of on decisions like that. You know, what is the intent? What's the intention behind it? It can be as subtle as coming in here to sit down, and coming into this room and looking around and noticing who's sitting here before you, and then you decide to go sit somewhere. But there's an intention preceding that desire to choose that particular seat. And there could be a whole range of intentions. It could be intention to choose a place where you can see the speaker most clearly. You can have the intention to choose a place that close to the door in case the talk's not going right. Or your meditation isn't going right. You can go in and say, well, you know, that person, I don't like that person. So based on a motivation of aversion, you know, so it's in the opposite side of the room. Or you come in, you see someone, and they're just like, wow, that person is, like, so attractive. Ooh. You know, wow. You know, it's really nice to come. I'm here. It's really nice. I'm so happy to be here. I'm in a place where I'm coming to be free and liberated and compassionate and not to act on every whim. And I think I'll go sit next to that person. Right next to me, I can talk to him or her. So there's all these little intentions that can precede even a simple choice as where we're going to sit in the room. And it's more subtle than that. The very posture you're sitting in right now, there was an intention that preceded that posture you're sitting in. There's a choice that you made in taking the posture you have right now. Are you aware that you made a choice to take that posture? All of you. Are you aware of that?
I was mandated to sit this way.
Even if you're mandated to sit that way, it's your choice to follow through on that. And there's choices behind it. I saw this very dramatically after living about 3 years in a Zen monastery, where a lot of the normal choices we make in our lives is made for you in a monastery. It's very regulated, pretty much. And you do all this in a certain schedule. Bell rings, and you stand up. Bell rings, you sit down. And you sit in a certain posture always. And it's very freeing, in a sense, to have all these choices made for you. But then, after 3 years in the monastery, I went back to San Francisco. And suddenly, I had to make choices in things that was not, you know, just all kinds of areas. And one of the places that really surprised me was that when I, maybe partly because we didn't sit in chairs very much in the monastery, was I became aware of that sitting in a chair was not a simple act. Sitting in a chair was actually a complicated act because there was a lot of different various ways I could choose to sit in a chair. And when I got a sense of the wide range of ways I could choose to sit in a chair, I realized that there was an intention that preceded my choice of how I sat in that chair. I could sit, you know, with certain dignity or some straightness. I could sit in a way that reinforced feelings of dejection or feelings of discomfort or feelings of embarrassment or feelings of you know, just a whole range of kind of express a certain intention, a certain orientation in the way I chose to sit. There are people who almost always, this is not always the case, but will sit with both knees kind of up against their chest, always. And sometimes there's expresses an intention of fear or protection. It's something they can express there. There are people who, you know, you name it. I mean, you can probably fill in better than I can the different examples of the choices we make in the way we choose to sit. So to pause for a moment, maybe not literally pause in our actions, but to kind of take a moment before we choose to do something new and ask ourselves, you know, why am I doing this? What's the intention that's going to be this is going to be infused with? Am I going to infuse this with a certain kind of intention? And then if it's an intention or an impulse which maybe doesn't serve you very well, do you have the freedom or the ability to drop it and choose something else? The greater the mindfulness, the greater is your choice, your ability to choose. The stronger and more precise you can see what's happening each moment, the greater is your range of choice. A person who doesn't see choice doesn't have choice. And if a person doesn't have choice, then they're subject to the winds of conditions, conditionality, of propaganda, of commercials, of advertisement, of opinions of others, and all kinds of things like that. The impulses that precede have tremendous power on our life. Some years ago, I met a Zen student, Zen teacher, who had done some 25 years of Zen practice. And I didn't have a sense from this person that he had a lot of wisdom or a lot of great, you know, realization experiences or anything. But the thing that that inspired me so much in meeting this person was I felt the power of 25 years of very dedicated intention to live to be present, to be free, to be compassionate. This person had followed through on that intention over and over and over again. And it was kind of this shining quality to that person because you could feel the cumulative effect of that intention. Someone else can choose for 20, 25 years to act on intentions of always complaining, or always criticizing other people, always judging people, or always doing something very kind of much more in the kind of opposite end of the spectrum. And the 20, 25 years of doing that will also cause that character of that person to kind of shine in a certain way. Or maybe not shine, but you know, to show itself in a different way. Intention is very powerful, and it's a very beautiful part of people. I could go on and on, but I probably talked enough. Do you want to say anything? Questions or comments? Yes?
You mentioned at the beginning that you wonder sometimes when you hear about meditation happening in the military or in corporate America and what the intention is. Knowing what you know, do you have faith that that intention would change to the Buddhist tradition, or could these people be doing a mindfulness practice for many, many, many years and just get more efficient, more efficient in their
healing? I don't remember. Anecdote. Maybe you remember, Shaila. There's a story that circulates in our circle. Maybe some of you remember, of someone teaching mindfulness to the Green Beret, I think it was. And so at the end of teaching the mindfulness, they were going to have like a retreat, like a 10-day retreat. And so he was teaching this. They were doing basically intensive meditation practice, and he was sitting with them, meditating with them, and these guys were wearing these T-shirts, and one of them said. T-shirt said something like "Born to Kill," or and it was a juxtaposition of my teaching mindfulness to these people and this, you know, "Born to Kill." But to answer your question, it's my faith, or my best understanding, that mindfulness itself is very powerful, and is self-correcting, or corrects our unwholesome tendencies. It's not the acts of greed, motivations of greed, hatred, and delusion require a certain mindless preoccupation. And it's almost impossible to maintain the momentum of this mindless preoccupation that leads to greed, hate, and delusion if you're being mindful. So as the mindfulness gets developed, I think there's both the dropping of those preoccupations and increase sensitivity to the life around us, so that we do there is a kind of corrective quality. So I think it's great that people in the military in that sense do mindfulness, because in the long term it's my faith that it'll change them for the better. I think mindfulness always brings out the best in people, because the worst in people simply can't survive with mindfulness. Yeah.
I have two small children, and even though I have the greatest intention to be a good parent, and I do want the best for them, I respond, I react in quick situations, and I'm a jerk. And I just, finding that, I like what you just said about the faith that the mindfulness will bring forth the best in us. But sometimes I respond and I don't know what I've responded.
Right. So you're a jerk. So what interests me before answering addressing your kind of concern more directly, what I find most interesting is, how do you relate to yourself when you see your limitations like that?
Critical.
And is it necessary to be critical? Critical means what for you?
Self-possessed.
So you're judgmental and judgmental and critical in the sense of kind of aversion towards yourself. My interests lead me to be interested in seeing if your attitude towards yourself, your understanding of your own limitations, can be changed, so that you don't have to be so hard on yourself for having limitations, for acting maybe inappropriately with your kids sometimes, but not to treat yourself hard because of that. We all have limitations, so start there. Start and see if you can be more kind and compassionate to yourselves. When you started off by saying your intention is to be kind to your kids or to be good to your kids, so trust that intention, and can you also kind of extend that to be kind to yourself and be kind to yourself when you find yourself making mistakes? Because if we become critical in the way you talked about, if we have aversion to ourselves, I suspect that we're actually increasing the chance, increasing our alienation from ourselves, increasing how uncomfortable we are inside of ourselves, deep inside, and we're setting up the conditions to more likely act impulsively in the future. So start by finding some way to be kind and accepting of yourself for your imperfections. And then it's a matter of mindfulness practice. And as your mindfulness practice gets stronger, you'll notice that there's actually different compartments or levels of intentionality. And when you're quiet and calm and can reflect on your life, there's maybe a deeper intentionality of being really helpful for your kids. But then there's another compartment, another level, of maybe kind of more superficial level, that seems to be the one has all the energy. And so there's an intention to be unkind sometimes. You call it just a response, but there's an intention behind that response, you know, intention to be unkind can arise because we haven't learned how to be comfortable with our own discomfort, and we sometimes then inappropriately put the blame on others for what's uncomfortable. You know, you're the cause of it, so I'm going to do something to you. So the mindfulness then will help us start becoming more comfortable with discomfort and uncomfortable situations. And I know that when we have kids at home, there's a lot of opportunity for discomfort. And now, what do I do? You know, 3:30 in the morning, and my kid doesn't want to sleep. I'm miserable. You know, I need to sleep. You know, and what's going on here? I can't stand it, and I'm uncomfortable. And you know, on and on goes the litany, right? You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to blame an 11-month-old child, you know, and be critical and kind of slap them and say, "You shut up! You know, be quiet! You know, who are you? Who are you to cause me all this distress?" But that's sometimes the impulse. In that kind of situation, most people maybe wouldn't do it. But in other situations, I would blame my wife. Sometimes I blame my wife, you know, for my own discomfort. I don't like what's going on. I say, "What's wrong with her?" And I don't look at myself. So the mindfulness practice helps us look at ourselves, and it takes time. You have to be very patient, because it takes time for the mindfulness to develop and get deeper and stronger. But if you start noticing patterns in the ways in which you respond, if you tend to respond in certain ways, then sometimes you can use that knowledge to set up certain feedback systems that can help you just before, just after you begin responding in a certain way. So for example, if you notice that you tend to be most angry and upset with your children after coming home from work, when you're really tired and exhausted, maybe you need to rethink about how you come home from work. And maybe there's a way you can come back more skillfully, or maybe some different way you can act when you came home when you're really tired. Or say it's not with your kids, but say, or maybe it's with your kids. If they're old enough, you can say that when everybody's happy and fine, you can say, "You know, I want to talk to you guys about something. Mommy has a problem with anger. That's just the way it is. And I want you to learn that it's okay to be angry. You don't have to be critical. Everybody has anger at times. It's not a terrible thing to be angry. But I don't want to act on my anger when I'm angry. And I want you guys to help me. And the next time you notice that I get angry at you, wink. Or raise your hand and say, 'Time out.'" Just maybe raise your hand. "Time out. Time out, Mommy. Time out means we have 2 minutes of silence." So you set up a system, you know, if you know, some kind of feedback system where you enlist people's help, maybe. So all kinds of things. So that's my response to you. One more? Yes.
Towards the beginning, you were talking about memories were surfacing, and you kind of caught yourself and said, I don't want to use the word unconscious. I just wondered about your intentions of not using that word unconscious.
Because the word unconscious is a huge kettle of fish. I don't want to open the door of what is the unconscious and where is it and what's the Buddhist understanding of it. And I'd rather not talk about it, so that's why I quickly switched, hoping no one would ask me. So let's end with 5 minutes of sitting, and then I'll have a couple of announcements.